reworking my understanding of purity. Raised as I was, you kept out the stuff other churches were doing and saying so as not to catch their lazy, sloppy, dubious habits and doctrine. And you kept out of this world so as not to catch all that sensual, self-indulgent, self-pleasing, God-dishonoring evil. This is why, as a teenager, I didn't go to movies or have a VCR in my house or look at pornography or swear or drink alcohol outside of the Sunday morning service, nor generally make friends with this world. I didn't want to take the wrong side. I didn't want to betray God. The thing is, Cain didn't have a television. He didn't listen to Judas Priest either. Now, where exactly did Cain's urge to murder come from, if not from watching Game of Thrones or playing Call of Duty? The Bible seems to present pretty clearly that evil comes into the world through the human heart, rather than the other way around. Jesus says it's not what goes into you, your mouth, your eyes, your ears, so much as what comes out of you, words and actions, that defiles you. The rottenness is within. We are imperfect. We have perverse urges to cheat, to lie, to manipulate, to bully, to steal. Because doing things right can be very scary. We know very well that the real thing to do is to speak truth, to deal with other human beings without resorting to bullying, lying, or manipulating, and to acquire things honestly. Scheming, lying, and cheating invalidate and corrupt the whole endeavor. We know this. But back in the day, parents were worried that if their innocent little kids saw the Roadrunner drop a piano on Wile E. Coyote, that their kids would laugh because the cartoon had put into their previously pristine little hearts a brand new, morbidly learned, unnatural delight in the misfortunes of others. Just like nowadays, parents are worried their kids might want to worship Satan and do magic if they watch movies about Harry Potter instead of good old Gandalf and Aslan. But back in the day, there were a lot of magazine articles, Christian and otherwise, about the corrupting influence of Wile E. Coyote, rock music, and action movies. This is still a big debate. Let's take the piano-dropping Roadrunner again. Are the kids laughing because the horrible thing hasn't really happened? And not to them, but only in a hugely exaggerated way to a purely fictional cartoon character? So they're imagining how much it would suck if it really happened and feeling almost a relief about this lucky escape? That they've lived thus far without any pianos falling on them? That the world being depicted is cartoonish, exaggerated, and unrealistic? Or are they laughing because it's so well-timed and unexpected? Because in the context of the story, it's perfectly set up, yet still surprising, still absurd. Or are they laughing because it is deeply human to laugh when others get hurt, and those kids came with that built into them, and this cartoon was designed to depict something that would resonate with little human beings in their natural state? Or is laughter, like tears, a way of venting the energy conjured by a sudden emotional reaction to unexpected things? I felt back in the day like we were getting mixed signals as Christian kids. We were taught that each human being was born with the capacity to do the very worst kinds of sins built right into us. We were told over and over again how we needed to read the Bible, pray, go to the meetings, and failing all of that, trust God, or else we would instantly become the very worst kinds of sinners, regular, worldly children. Old brethren, men and women who'd never seen a television show or drank a glass of wine would go on and on about how if they let slip just once, they could just feel how they'd all too soon become a goat-raping serial killer who loved television. Well, perhaps people like old Mrs. Smith didn't word it quite like that, but the implications and what they said were, I thought, clear to all of us. Man, would they sin without the meeting lifestyle, peer pressure, and rules holding them in check. Sin management. Because we were all horrible people inside, deep down. But then they'd kind of turn around and speak of the depravity of this world, and how seductive it was, and deceitful, and how we needed to keep well clear of all the fun things it had on offer, to keep ourselves clean from it. Wait, we were clean now? I was a weird child. So one weekend on holiday at my uncle's house in Mississauga, I read The Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan, and its sequel. They were predictably Puritan, though I didn't know what that meant at the time, depicting the world as a place filled with tempting cities and bad company one could fall into, a just-say-no theology, subtractive virtue. But there was this one part that gave me new thoughts that hadn't ever come up at meeting. The allegorical Christians in Bunyan's book are given white robes, And when they are going on their journey, people throw dirt on them, and it magically slides off and doesn't defile their white robes, like, at all. What? I thought. They were walking through the world, and once they got spiritual enough or were on a path of growth and progressing toward God, it wasn't about locking themselves away from this world. And as they walked right through it, they didn't have to worry about getting defiled so much anymore. It wasn't their primary preoccupation to keep their skirts clean. Now it was actually about where they were headed in their self-cleansing robes. And then I noticed that in the Old Testament, there wasn't any shame tied into all those ritualistic washings. If you carried the remains of a dead family member to their grave, if you defecated, if you menstruated, if you ejaculated, if you gave birth, if you did any number of quite normal proper things, you had to wash yourself and undergo ritualistic cleansing afterward. You were unclean, often until the evening. But you weren't ashamed. You just washed and waited. Those Old Testament folk were pragmatic people. You worked and lived your life, and if you did certain things, you needed to wash before shaking other people's hands, hugging them, sitting at table with them, and passing around food. It was not, for them, a shame thing. It was just a life thing. And in the New Testament, Jesus didn't teach his disciples not to walk around Judea because it would make their feet dirty. He walked everywhere and wanted his feet washed when he arrived at your house. So this too was something I started to learn in my 20s. Life defiles us. Anyone who's cleaned up after a rugby game, sexual encounter, or childbirth can tell you that the more full of life an act is, the more likely there is to be perhaps a certain amount of pain in with the joy and perhaps a huge mess. And there is really no place for shame in it. Shame is always divisive. It doesn't help in making connections. It isn't inspiring. Life involves getting your hands and other parts of you dirty. And then we have soap and water. I began to realize that as a kid, my parents hadn't actually been primarily concerned that watching the Dukes of Hazzard would dirty or wound my soul. They spoke this way, but that's not what was really going on. It wasn't that it would be bad for me inside at all. It seems it was more about the risk that my enjoying that television activity might make me look normal and usual, making it impossible for onlookers to tell that I was in that inner circle of correct saints, making it impossible for me to be a good testimony. Because if a random person laid eyes on me sitting there delighting in the improbable feats of an orange 1967 Dodge Charger, how would they even know I was a Christian? At school, the other kids were going to ask, "Did you see the A-Team last night?" If I had said, "Yeah," how would they have even known I was a Christian? If I dressed, combed my hair, or spoke or moved like the people on television, if I loved the things the people in this world loved, how exactly would I be different? What if the rapture happened right when I was watching TV? What a dishonor to the Lord. Well, as I said, as a child I was always much more worried that the rapture would happen while I was on the toilet, whooshed up to the sky to meet Jesus still squatting awkwardly with my pants down. But TV would have been pretty bad. In my assembly, they often quoted the verse about how the Israelites were to be a peculiar people. So we were to be peculiar too, peculiarly disengaged from joy and all joyful pursuits. If the world did something fun, we had to go to meeting instead. I got a clear message that being a Christian wasn't about being given something from God. It was about us giving things up for God. It wasn't really that I had something the other children were supposed to see and want for themselves. Not really. I was raised mainly to not have what everyone else had. In theory, the idea was that all of the prayer and Bible reading and going to meetings was supposed to pretty much fill the time I would otherwise have spent doing fun things, and that I'd not even want television and movies and music if I had these Christian things instead. But that didn't work. Proof positive that I was carnal and sold under sin, loving the things of this world. In my 20s, I found I was filling my weeks up with less and less meeting. So I had to come up with what a pure, wholesome, good, fulfilling, edifying, useful life might look like, even without that demanding meeting timetable. The method behind all the life advice, behind the required brethren lifestyle, really seems to boil down to this. Guard your heart. Close it tight. Keep out the other churches, keep out the other Christians, keep out all the fun things in this world. Keep yourself clean, and keep your brethren indoctrination and status safe. cherish your meeting peculiarity. Never stoop to trying to pass for usual. But many of us, raised according to this plan, had found that the meeting hurt many of us rather than keeping us safe. Despite being in with this world locked out, we Christians brought all manner of corrupting and damaging crap into the meeting settings, and we got it from within our hearts. Some of it we invented ourselves, finding ways to hurt and cheat and sin without breaking any of the rules, really. Christians did not, as promised, consistently show each other forgiveness, grace, and mercy in a special Christian way that the children of darkness in this world would know nothing about. There are evil things, dirty things, hurtful and twisted things that don't require television. Satan wasn't only active at rock concerts and while people played Dungeons and Dragons. He was very active among us, in our brethren culture. We had suicides in the TW Brethren group I was part of. In the broad circle of people we knew from other TW assemblies, we knew of incest and rape. We had child molesters who were tyrants in their local assemblies for decades. We had aborted incest babies. We had insanity. We had stalkers and pedophiles. We even had murder. I spent a fair bit of time at Bible conferences, in fact, hanging out with someone who later went on to murder his sister in their kitchen on Lord's Day. And the idea that these kinds of sins went along with a carelessness of lifestyle, an association with this world, and a lack of attendance at meeting or interest in the things of the Lord wasn't the case. Zealous people sin too, zealously. In fact, all too frequently, one finds sexual abusers being characterized by black and white thinking coupled with legalistic position taking and power seeking. A real zeal to punish people who do different sins than they do. So I was trying to come up with better ideas as to what pure actually looked like. Having rules didn't seem to fix us inside. What did it mean to let Jesus in? Was that different from following the rules? This all took some thinking.